I'm Sean Stromberg. I think the only UCSB affiliate that's speaking here, so I welcome everybody to Santa Barbara. I'm a theoretical physics postdoc with Gene Carlson here and in the physics department, not the KITP. And I guess the last 4 days I've actually been doing some experimental immunology in that me and the other three members of my family have all had the stomach flu. So I think there's a good chance that some of the slides might reflect that. And at the same time, I also had a hard drive crash. So this talk was supposed to have all those PowerPoint effects, you know, like explosion sounds and stuff. And it has to go off of a PDF because I'm using somebody else's computer. But anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of how we might approach flow cytometry data differently, and a bigger question of how we might think about systems biology when there's selection on the population. So most systems biology models just consider the within cell biology, but if you have a dividing population or you have a population that is being selected in some way, either for division or death, then really the gene and protein expression is we expect to be governing the selection rules. And so that ends up biasing the distributions that we see. I'll just sort of get started. The way we normally model immune responses is with these sort of well-defined phenotype models using ODEs. The sort of canonical example is that we have a naive effector and memory pathway. The reality of the data is that it never really looks so well-defined. Here is one way that naive effector and memory cells are defined, and you can see that the thresholds that we draw when we count up the number of cells in each of these bins, the bins aren't really very well defined often in the data. And so I started thinking about how we might use within cell models to better describe the data, and that's what the talk is going to be focused on. And the approach that we've taken to model the dynamics of the expression profiles directly by considering the forces that govern the shape. So that's considering primarily within cell chemical kinetics, also considering the stochastic effects of the chemical kinetics. Expression dependent cell death and division rates, dilution of expression with cell division. And you can factor in additional migration and discrete phenotypic changes that are sort of well described by discrete states like transcription factor binding. But really it's sort of extending the well-defined phenotype notion onto a continuous state space. So the approach generates partial differential equations to describe evolution of the population of cells in a continuum. And there are models that do this. I think, Robin, you and Andy have a nice paper on TBET transcription that was really a motivating factor for developing sort of these techniques. So I'd love to find out what you guys think of this stuff. So normally these two things are done separately. The within cell systems biology describes complex chemical kinetics of a single cell. But usually population effects bias the observations in a natural system. And the contrasting is looking at population dynamics, and usually the models study well-defined populations and consider rapid transitions between those populations. But the standard models sort of fail when it comes to heterogeneity or gradual transitions. And so we need an integrated approach. Expression governs cell proliferation and death, and cell death and proliferation biases the expression profiles. So it makes sense to do this in an integrated way. It's too bad Anton isn't here. I really like the narrations he did at the chalkboard the other day, and so I thought I might just outline the approach that way, if you don't mind. So usually we start off and write systems biology equations for some number of chemicals. Set of chemicals, some function. And for example, this might just be a normal some normal constant production with a proportional decay, something like that. But in general, it'll be a function of a number of chemicals, and we'll have a large system of these equations, and we can write that more succinctly with a vector notation. AT equals some vector function. And the way we usually think about it is A1 versus time, and A2 versus time. A1 might have some chemical that's coming up over time, and A2 maybe something a little more gradual. The approach is to sort of instead think about this in a chemical phase. I guess a phase plane is the right word. A1 and A2. So we sort of started off low with each of these, and then A1 was more rapid, and then A2 a bit more gradual, and it comes up to a point there. And now to recognize that the our set of ordinary differential equations defines a vector field in this space. And it defines sort of an attractor that the cells are progressing to. When we do it this way and talk about the single cell as a point in the space, that allows us to also ask the question, well, what is the dynamics of a distribution in the space? We can set down a big blob of something that a distribution might describe a large population of cells that's going to then differentiate as described by the vector field. So, is everybody following that okay so far? So, in order to come up with the right dynamical equation.
So, if the population, if the variation A1 and A2 are the rate constants, what do you envision is causing this blob?
What do I envision is causing the blob?
I mean, yeah, what's the heterogeneity?
Well, so it could just be initial conditions, but there could be, so I guess I have written this as a deterministic system. Maybe that's the issue. I could also add on a stochastic term here. This is tensor. So the idea is, I guess you have diffusion. If I had a single particle, I would get because if I incorporate noise, I get some fluctuations as I go. And if I look at a distribution of particles, then it gives a spread to the distribution. Does that answer the question? Okay.
So I guess just to follow up, so here you're thinking of these chemicals, A1 through whatever it is, AN, as being in a single cell?
Yeah, as being in a single
cell. So the primaries you put in your equations describe a single cell. Now, when you move to a population, it's not only sort of noise and initial conditions, but we'd expect the parameters governing these things might also be very different. So the trajectory and principle in each cell could also be different.
Right, so
or closely related.
The cells all have the same DNA. And so they should all have the same, they don't have the same DNA.
Epigenetics.
Okay.
They have the same DNA, but some have one promoter, some have two promoters. So.
Yeah.
So they're not identical.
So I think, I think you're right. There are things that are described on a continuum, and there are things that are described discretely. And I think for getting at things that are described well by a continuum, this is a good approach. And then you can have multiple sort of continuous states to think about.
Single-cell experiments kind of address that kind of question? Is it just intrinsic stochasticity, or there's really inherent differences between cells that we think are identical, DCR transgenic T cells, which he wants that you take them, you think they're all identical, so they have all the same parameters, and whatever distribution you get is due to noise versus noise plus.
Right, different. Except when we look at these single cell experiments, and you see the cells of different fates and different things. Bill, does that speak very well to that?
But they could be stochastic, of course, right?
So I guess your model will work well in some instances and less well in others, depending on how
So I think,
can you kind of step into the question?
How do we analyze flow cytometry data in a more informed way? So I don't know. I guess there's a lot of different questions that I think that the material answers, but that's what really motivated the studies. So I think the questions that you were asking, I think that this method is still a step in the right direction from the typical models that we use.
But the A's and internal parameters, or the things that coupled to what the markers are on the surfaces, or what?
They are the markers on the surface. Yeah.
From its flow data, it's fluorescence associated with an antibody binding to the thing on the surface.
Yeah, well, let's just say that that was a really good description of the things that we're looking at. I want to describe expression and not fluorescence. So I would assume that there's some convolution that would give you fluorescence from that, but that's not the question. Is that okay?
Okay.
Does anybody want to talk about it some more?
Yeah, I guess maybe you could to analyze the cytometry data for what? I mean, what things are you trying to get out from?
Okay, so the
information or?
Yeah. So a lot of times I'll see some data analysis in immunology where they'll have a distribution of cells that looks something like this, A1 and A2. The first thing that's done is to describe this as plus minus and this as minus plus. Then the next thing is to ignore all the cells up there, ignore all the cells down there, describe these two populations as very well defined, ignoring all the heterogeneity in the data. it's a cartoon, and I'm like tearing it apart just to make an example. But actually, that's a really useful method too. So in some ways, and for some things, this type of analysis breaks down. That's why I'm doing this. But then I think it brings up more interesting questions when you sort of do a reductionist approach. You get at some more fundamental biological questions. Does that kind of get at?
I'll expect the question will come through.
Okay. So.
I think it's an extremely important point. So there are these subsets. So like for example, the classical subset, well, classical in some way, effector memory, central memory cells. That people define based on CCR7 and CDC2L, the same expressions. The same thing. So you don't get two populations of cells, two populations CCR positive, CCR7 positive and negative cells. So you have something into intermediate. And what does it mean in terms of like their migration patterns or other kinds? So kind of, I think having a model that predicts a distribution is definitely.
Yeah, I think what would be nice is instead when we look at that, to say if we looked at that bigger picture here, to say if I pick a cell from here, what's the probability that it's well described by that phenotype versus that phenotype, I think there's better ways of describing.
Not the current approach, but the different approach maybe what people do is
more appropriate statistician, they don't do lines, they do cluster analysis.
Okay.
They are not in that way, the multidimensional space. So it's not the point that you identify. It actually can be very well clustered.
Yeah.
Even though on this axis.
I think the clustering analysis clustered. Is still sort of an unsupervised approach, right?
Yeah, so there's quite a number of methods now existing that are unsupervised or partially supervised. At least you identify clusters of cells. And there are divisions, much better divisions, that sometimes you cannot see in the 2D. This is just 2D, and you see that there's a, but if you include more and more markers, you can see actually these cells are separate cells.
So there was a paper.
It's just our
So the separate in the statistical sense of what they are, so they could be multiple markers and things. But then the separate as far as they're doing something different biologically.
Oh, then what people do is they transfer them into another model, yes, a model, so then see if they do something different. And often they do.
It's the sort of the question you're trying to get at is, you know, so one part you call these separate cells, but they come from some sort of continuum process. And so you're trying to develop the mathematical framework to describe that continuum and the factors that influence
it. And it's sort of a different way to think about things, too. If we sort of construct a set of equations like this, then those end up being common to all the cells in the system. So rather than enumerate phenotypes, we sort of have a description that's common to all the cells, and we see the different phenotypes as arising from the dynamical rules. Yeah.
I think that maybe something else might be unfair is in those equations, you could have also Boolean stochastic effect like chromatin remodeling. If you have a single cell model, you can include in it chromatic remodeling. And so that single cell model can describe all sorts of, I don't believe, of phenotype. And then when you look at phase space, you could think about the noise in the single cell, but now you have several single cells that are noisy. And in addition, you have self-survivability in the naturally.
Yeah, I think this is also a good approach sort of as a null model in order to figure out if we should expect there to be some epigenetic factors. If I get to it, I've got a bit on epigenetic modeling and with a similar framework. But I'm not confident. Okay, so the next step is if I want to construct dynamical equations to describe a distribution in the space, I start by defining some region here, omega, and I'm assuming that this would be beneficial for some people and annoying for others, so I hope you don't mind if I just jump in and do it.
Push on.
Okay, thank you. So what I do is I integrate the density in that region omega. Take the time derivative. And that is equal to the integral of this. Of the normal vector times the flux crossing the surface over the whole boundary. So this is the vector, this is the velocity, and that's the density. So that gives the number of cells that are right on this edge that are going to be crossing over in some differential amount of time. Over here, I use identity from vector calculus that gives me the divergence So instead of an integral over the boundary, I get an integral over the volume. And over here, I can bring the total derivative inside to get partial derivative. And since I haven't defined what omega is, this ends up being general over any region. Sorry, just d rho dt equals negative del gamma rho. Okay, so this is just an advection equation. We can actually set everything up as a chemical master equation for all the different chemical species that are interacting. And if you expand it in a Fokker-Planck expansion to lowest order, you'll get the exact same term. If I started off with Langevin equations, that those are equations that have an additional stochastic term, then I would get an advection diffusion equation. And same thing if I started with a chemical master equation and expanded it to the next highest order. And so what you end up with is plus del dot, this is a diffusion tensor. It has to be a tensor because you have anisotropic system. You might have noise fluctuations in different directions that are larger. And so there are a number of ways to derive that last term, which I probably avoid if I can, unless people are really interested. Okay, and so now this describes the within cell biology applied to a population. And then the key bit here is to add the population dynamics onto this. So if I have cell death, I might add an expression dependent cell death term times rho. And now I think cell division ends up being the most interesting here. If I have cell division, I'm going to be removing cells from location A because I'm partitioning the contents of the cells into two pools. I'm going to be adding two cells from 2A, and additionally, I have to add a factor of 2 to the D here. This funny factor here comes from non-local calculus. If you're going to be taking cells from one region and adding them to another, you have to consider that I'm adding to a region A plus BA, but it's coming from a region 2A plus 2DA, which is twice as wide as this region. And in a higher dimensional space, I get that factor 2 and D. Additionally, I might have things that are better described by discrete components, so I get same thing, 2DT, and so on. And that could also incorporate migration or something. So this is nice because it gives us things that are in terms of advection diffusion equation. The reason is that that's nice is because we want to do immunology and not figure out numerical algorithms that are numerically stable and optimized for speed. So if it's in terms of something that corresponds with fluid dynamics, engineers have done a lot of work to make those types of algorithms. So you can find all that work is already done. You can do nice simulations of, I guess this non-local bit, I haven't found any work, but that was not as difficult as you would think to implement. So let's see, I've got a number of examples here. I'll turn that off. Did anybody have any questions about that before I continue?
What's keeping count of how many cells you have in your system? So in your equation, you're kind of generating things back into the population, but your population, you probably started out with something that looked kind of normalized or something.
I did. It's described by these additional terms that are, so the initial part, the advection diffusion part is conservative. And so whatever you start with is whatever you're going to have later. And then all the additional terms, just like an ODE, they account for changes in the population. So, that's nice. You get you have a changing population, which is what we have in immunology.
I presume ultimately you would contemplate playing with not making two cells that look identical, either for the extreme of Sarah's asymmetric cell division, or because you expect it to be a noisy division.
Yeah. Right. So that's a good point. So usually you would expect to have some partition noise. And in that case, you have to append this. I don't have that in this talk, but we thought about it a bit. So in that case, when you're adding to the population, you actually are adding, and you have an integral because you're coming from a some region that's localized around 2A. So yeah, that's a really good point. And then, this is considering symmetric cell division. For asymmetric cell division, and I'd like to really look at that because that's a mechanism that generates heterogeneity in the population. So here's just a simple example to kind of illustrate where the normal ecological models of well-defined phenotypes succeed and where they sort of start to break down. So this is just a transcription factor binding model. Their cell can be in two states, one where production is low and one where production is high. And then there's a regular Poisson rate of transcription factor binding. When it binds, the production goes high. So in the first case, here transcription factor binding is gradual, but then the transition is rapid. So day zero, everything is localized around first peak, and then as transcription factor binds, things move rapidly to the second peak. And if you do the regular type of analysis and count the number of cells on the left-hand side and plot that as a function of time, you get a nice curve that's well described by an exponential decay. Contrasting that a case where transcription factor binding is rapid, but then the transition is gradual. And if you put your threshold there and count the number of cells, you get something that has a shape to it that's not well described by the simple exponential decay. And if you wanted to describe that with ODE models, you can, but it's not clear that those would really reflect the biology. Ben is not here anymore, but I think that in his talk there were a couple issues that really we started to see sort of these effects because we were looking at something on a flow, and I was hoping to get some feedback from him. So does anybody have any questions on that before I continue? So really, when you have a gradual transition in the observed phenotype, that's where the ODE models start to break down.
Okay. Can I see again what is K?
K is the rate of transcription factor binding. Do you want me to stay here for a minute? Do you want me to go back a little bit? Okay. Do you want me to tell you about all the visual effects that were going on?
Is anything known about what the actual rates are? Which scenario is more likely kind of occur for some transcription factors? Is it fast K slow beta or slow beta fast?
Well, I think it depends on the phenomena that you're interested in.
So there are examples for both?
I mean, it's the resolution that you're looking at, I think.
There's no question you see this kind of effect, as you say. Like, often you look at a gradual shift that might well be explained.
So, I mean, memory differentiation takes...
This particular description of the process or some other is unclear.
The differentiation from... effector to central memory seems like it takes 120 days or something. It takes a
really, I don't know if it's related to transcription factors.
Oh, sure.
I'm talking about kinetics of transcription factor binding and production and turnover types. This kind of what is known.
Yeah, it would be helpful to have a number of examples.
You know, they have to be phosphorylated, some of them. You get engineering of this initial bearing outside, and then many things could be very fast in terms of, get tossed transcription facts for sort of like going to nucleus operating expression.
But your main message is in red down there that this fails. You don't even need to really understand the underlying process to take your approach to resolve things.
And yeah, and if you stick with the ODEs, you can describe it, but it sort of misleads you on what's going on biologically, I think. Okay, so that was supposed to go. That was very exciting. Okay, so just the takeaway was that gradual differentiation requires integrating systems. Okay, so I've got a couple slides on some things that become interesting when you have cell division. I mentioned that already. So you can do a dye. In that case, the advection and the diffusion terms are just zero because the dye isn't being produced in the cells. So it's just being partitioned each time you have a cell division. And so here's a simulation. I did that. I guess, I don't know, does anybody have any questions there? This is just using exponential rate for division, not log normal distribution for division times. And maybe if people are interested in thinking about changing that, we could. Anton had the age structured model for that, and I think this is a similar approach.
Is that equation right? Because it seems like it's backwards. It looks like you're gaining cells with 2A, losing cells with A.
That's right.
But if you're dividing, then you isn't the amount of dye going to be go from 2A to A? You should be gaining things at A and losing with 2A.
Well, yeah, I've got. If a cell divides at 2A, I'm gaining it at A, right? And then if a cell at A divides, then it's taking away from the population.
All right, great.
So I think when I wrote the paper, I went back and forth with the plus and minus. But now I'm clear. Actually, this too is really important here, especially if you're trying to estimate division rates and stuff.
Can you explain that in more detail? I'm still not so clear.
Yeah.
You get a floor there.
Right. So, I mean, it really...
Could you turn on the lights, please?
Yeah. Thank you very much. So can everybody see if I'm over here? I can go back, I guess. This slide had some...
No, you can't. You got to the lights.
Oh, that doesn't... Okay, never mind. I'll go to the
middle one. Can you control the middle one?
Yeah, that's the middle switch there.
If you put the middle switch right
down. So, yeah. I'm concerned with what's going on, actually, in some region between A and some delta, A plus delta A, so some infinitesimal region here. And that is being fed from 2A plus 2 delta A, right? And so it's really, I mean, just as simple as the fact that I'm feeding from something that's twice as wide. I can't think of another way to explain it, I'm sorry. If it's higher dimensional, then I have an extra factor of 2 for each dimension. And so I have to have a 2 to the d for the dimensionality of the space when I add that.
Yeah, it's basically just, you know, as you take some region of your phase space and you scale it down by a factor of 2, that's how the volume changes.
Yeah. Thank you. I think it goes away if I'm working with the logarithm of
course,
expression.
Yeah.
And so the sorry, Ellen, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So here's just a same thing, but with just a regular constant production process, but with homeostatic division. So division and death are at the same rate here, so that the total number of cells is constant. And then I just have the within cell biology here, DADT equals alpha minus. So if the cells weren't dividing, I'd have this this L-shaped distribution of expression. But cell division gives a big spread for the distribution. Because when these cells are dividing, they're moving over here, and then they're sort of transiting back. And because I'm using an exponential division law, cells that are close to here can also divide, but really this spread is mostly due to the fact that I have spread over here, not to really rapid cell division. So it gives a breadth to the distribution that you wouldn't see in a non-dividing population.
Yeah, doesn't it make a difference if you're talking about total amount or the concentration?
It does, sorry. It's total amount, which is what you see with fluorescence, but so that's a good question. I think that we shouldn't expect everything to have the same production rates in the cell. So if cell divides and it's smaller, and then as it gets bigger, certain things will sort of remain at the same concentration. I think on average, you know, you would probably expect everything has the same concentration. I meant quantity, I guess. I think I said quantity. So the bit that I think is a little more crucial is that because everything is redistributed at the same time, cell division introduces correlations between unrelated gene products. So this is just a non-dividing population, the same way that we had that bell curve for a single gene. This is looking at two gene or protein expression levels. And the contours here are drawn with exponential difference between them. These are two completely unrelated genes, but you introduce correlations between them because everything is cut in half at the same time. And this is important because all the genetic regulatory network reconstruction algorithms assume that a correlation between two gene products is a connection in the regulatory network. And the effect is strongest between slow gene products. Is that okay? In an adaptive immune response, you start with a very small population of resting cells, and then they begin to divide rapidly. So I think that this dilution with cell division is really important for understanding an adaptive immune response. And so I want to know what extent the differentiation pattern we see is a result of the regulatory networks, and to what extent is it just this dilution? You expect to see a high-low-high expression resulting from division as the cells go from resting to dividing to resting again. A lot of that data is available for like microarray data, and you do see those trends, but microarray doesn't give you any information on the full distribution. So I'd like to find how to get at a lot of the flow data to sort of test these ideas. This is from a friend of mine at Emory. She just was looking at, she has CFSE and CD62L, which is going down over time with cell division at the beginning of adaptive immune response. And so the question here is CD62L downregulated by a change in production, or is it just being diluted? And CD62L is one of the main discriminators between effector and naive cells. So, and then here's a simulation just looking at the same thing, but here I think I have the production rate a lot higher than what would be predicted by that data. Okay, so this was supposed to be a nice movie, but I had a hard drive crash, and so I have to do the talk in a PDF. But what happens here is there's a source of cells here, and the vector field here is supposed to bring these cells up to here, but the bit on the horizontal axis controls division rate, and the vertical axis controls death rate. And what you would have seen if this was working is the population ends up being stable here, and this no single cell is ever stable, but the distribution that you see is stable because you have selection acting on the population. The chemical kinetics had predicted that I would end up with a stable distribution up here. It's not at all what you see, and so the point was that if you're going to go in and measure or estimate the within cell biology by looking at the distribution, you have to be careful that there's selection on the population, and so your inference is going to be heavily biased by selection. So if you use the integrated approach,
if the selection ends up with the distribution centered near the left corner, can it also end up with a bimodal distribution?
Actually, I have. I think the next slide, or I think we have a bimodal distribution in a couple slides on sort of some differentiation. But it really depends on how you're describing what the system is that you're interested in. So what is it about? Is there something particular to this that you think would have bimodal? I didn't see that in this simulation, but you're thinking that maybe some cells.
Well, I mean, presumably the division and death has to be some complicated function that they might make too.
Yeah. I just made it as simple as possible for this.
Presumably, we're thinking in terms of the data as all one cells.
Right.
And the situations in which you give something to do with the motor.
Right. Okay, so there's a bigger question, because we're sort of on the verge, maybe in the next 5 years, of getting just this tremendous data flux for single cell analyses of expression. The CyTOF, they think, will give up to 200 measurements per cell. It does thousands of cells per second. I think single cell RNA sequencing is something that a lot of people are working towards. So what can we do with distributional data that we can't really do with the regular microarray data? So microarray just gives us, you know, a normalized mean. So again, we can account for the spurious correlations that arise in genetic regulatory network reconstruction algorithms. So we can get a more high resolution reconstruction. We can also get directionality and figure out what the drivers are of differentiation from distributional data. So in this simulation, A1 is an autoregulator, but it also regulates A2. And we can see that from the where the differentiation is coming from. It's coming from a perturbation in A1, implying that A1 is also regulating A2. And you end up with This is not, I mean, eventually all cells will have changed to upregulating goals. So distributional data can also tell us what the drivers are of division, death, and migration. Yes, Ankar.
So have you actually figured out, is it CD62L being diluted or it's being downregulated?
No, I haven't figured it out. Are you interested in...
Most likely the initial cells were CD62L high, So, I mean, there's definitely, like, at zero division, you have already tons of cells that have CD62L low.
Okay.
Which actually, I mean, it's...
Down here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's known that actually CD62L is cleaved from the surface, even though we have intracellular protein. So it's not detected. It might be protein inside. Transcription may still have it, but it's not detected. And then there's a gap, okay? You don't see those cells, and then they appear again.
Right.
So...
So what do you think?
It's complicated.
Okay.
CD62L is one of the best
ones,
maybe.
I looked at some of the repositories online, and things from the mRNA have high, low, high expression, and there were something like 60 immunologically important factors in the data set I was looking at. So I'd like to be sort of comprehensive about looking at all of those with this sort of dilution model and see if there's a general trend in that direction or not. Because, you know, it might be being cleaved, but maybe that doesn't matter. I don't know. Maybe somebody else does.
I mean, just looking at the averages, I mean, it goes from average 2 × 10^4 to probably about 10^4. So,
yeah.
Say, roughly speaking, like if I look just at the red average.
Right.
And I mean, they do what, 4 divisions? Doesn't seem to be dilution only. I mean,
right.
It has to be production.
Yeah.
And it could be just dilution.
Yeah, it could be dilution and just the regular rate of production. And instead of seeing the big spread, you know, here that we might expect from those simulations, if I have log normal distribution, these cells down here aren't going to be. Log normal distribution. Yeah, so until they get upregulated some, I don't know. I mean, I have to be a little more careful.
I wonder
careful.
Whether you can have different models that will explain the same pattern.
Right.
So
there's
always dilution. We know there's dilution.
Yeah. But people rarely factor that into the analysis. I think it could be really important.
In CFSC, they do.
That's the only time. I mean, I think any time asymmetric cell division is going to be important, the dilution is going to also be important.
Does anybody ever do a sort of experiment where they can find out what the rate of production of, say, CD62L is by removing it all and then watching it come up again? I mean, I don't know anything about this. It seems like that would be an interesting thing to experiment to do to test your hypothesis.
There's a theorem in statistical physics called the fluctuation dissipation theorem, and that allows us to. I mean, it's model dependent, but it tells us if we can look at the spread in expression, but that also tells us both what the So you get the mean and the spread, and that enables you to figure out what the growth and the decay rates are. But looking at it directly, I'm sure somebody's done that. I mean, there's these different bleaching experiments and stuff, but I don't know.
Nobody's sticking their hand up, so.
Yeah.
So we have movies where we've got soluble low-level anti-CD62L antibody in the fluorescent in the movies. So would it help you to, you know, watch them as they divide and then as they...
Yeah.
So we could probably provide you with that data. You could walk through.
Yeah, that would be fine. Thank you. I don't know, what time is it? So it's 11. I have some stuff where we use this for looking at persistent infections, sort of use these techniques, because over a couple weeks during a persistent infection, T cells differentiate to an exhausted phenotype, and they have a couple different phenotypic changes. The key bit is that they really start dividing in response to antigen. So I don't know. We could take a break now and talk about that later if anybody's interested, or I could push on. I also at the end of the talk have some stuff on passive demethylation of DNA and how to sort of think about that with selection in mind. But this is the end of the 1 hour talk. I don't think anybody's ever stopped.
You need to entertain us for at least another hour.
Okay. So I guess I think nobody's really talked at this conference that I'm aware of. I missed the talk this week. There's this big question of what controls the pathogen load, and it's often not adaptive immunity. So it's usually assumed to be either adaptive immunity, innate immunity, or resource limitations for the virus. It looks like for influenza, there's a lot of data that suggests that it's actually innate immunity. Malaria, they can't figure out what it is that controls the initial, the acute stage of the infection, but it's clear that it's not adaptive immunity. HIV, actually, Rob is not here anymore, but he's got some stuff recently saying that during the controlling stage in an HIV infection, it looks like it is adaptive immunity. So this is one place that models are really important for figuring that out, because you see all the different signatures of each of these things in an immune response. You see T cells that are responding to the infections. You see innate immune mechanisms, and you really want to figure out what actually matters and what's just sort of there but not doing anything. So in a persistent infection, there is this additional bit that you have T cells that might be coming from the thymus during that persistent infection. There were some experiments that were done at Emory a couple years ago looking at the role of recent thymic immigrants to the control of a persistent infection. And so me and Rusty Mantia at Emory looked at modeling persistent infections with thymic influx in mind. And we had to do it on a continuum because there's this gradual differentiation to an exhausted phenotype for the T cells. Okay, so this is kind of what the data looks like in a chronic LCMV infection. And what they do here is they use an antibody to basically kill off the CD4 T cells. That eliminates any B cell response. If you have the B cell response, the red curve here is the virus. If you had the B cell response, you'd see that virus actually sort of be cleared after quite a while. I think it's at least 20 days. When they get rid of the CD4 T cells, then there's no B cell response, and the pathogen just persists indefinitely. This data looks at exhausted and non-exhausted T cells for two different epitopes, GP33 and NP396. And you see that there's one T cell population that's maintained over the long term. Other data shows multiple T cell clones that are maintained over the long term, which is interesting. We could talk about that.
So which are the exhausted and which are the...
Yeah, these... So actually this is what is expressing interferon gamma and what isn't. But this is total and this is interferon gamma expressing. So the ones that are expressing interferon gamma are low in number. And that is one of the signatures of exhaustion. So that means that almost the entire population is exhausted because they're not really seeing the high interferon gamma producing cells.
So the ones that aren't producing are exhausted.
That's right. Thank you. And then the sort of contrasting view here, this is from a paper by John Wary, and really everybody just concentrates on this column over here. Ignore the rest of these, but the blue curves here give the expression for an acute infection, and the red curves give the expression for the chronic infection. And so this is PD1, which is short for programmed death 1, which really seems like it's inhibiting division. And so I think an acute infection, the beginning of clearance is here at day 8, and it's cleared usually by day 12. So PD1 comes up a little bit in the acute infection and then goes back down to something that's pretty well described by the naive expression. But in the chronic infection, it just stays high. And then some of these other ones have a similar behavior, but I don't know. The analysis really just focused on PD1, and that's what most people talk about in as the key marker for expression, key marker for T cell exhaustion. I don't know why this is blank. So we constructed a model like the ones that I was talking about previously, where when a T cell is presented with antigen by a dendritic cell, it's upregulating. It's at least it has a change in the production rate of PD1. And then when the dendritic cells are removed, that sort of at least the pathogen expressing dendritic cells are removed, the expression of PD1 declines with time. And so we started with a fairly complicated model of two different phenotypic states for these population expression equations, and then a model of dendritic cells becoming activated with pathogen, and then reduced it down to a single partial differential equation that captures that. So there's a supplemental information with a couple pages of derivation that I don't think is inaccessible, but I'm not going to cover it unless people are more interested. Basically, A here is PD1 expression, delta is the rate that it decreases, and then I've actually normalized this so that it ranges from 0 to 1. So here the division of a high PD1 expression cell goes to 0. Every cell has a death rate D. And then this term here gives thymic influx, and we really didn't know how the infection is going to affect thymic influx, but we expected that it's going to reduce it in a lot of different ways. So this is a Hill function, just out of ignorance, but wanting some general function for reducing thymic influx. And so this term for influx, that I have new T cells that are going to be entering the population with 0 PD1 expression, and then I have to have the flux rate match up with the flux. And then this last bit here is the pathogen equation. So you can see there's a logistic term here for the pathogen. You can show that both a resource-limited model and an innate immunity model reduce to a logistic term like this when you just concentrate on the slow processes involved, which really underscores why it's so difficult to discriminate between innate and resource limitations. And the last bit here is pathogen being killed by T cells. And here, all T cells kill at the same rate, K. Does anybody have any questions about the model before I kind of talk about results?
So you mentioned that this, the first term in the second bracket it's somehow related to division. Is there's no division in this equation, right?
No, I'm sorry, there's not. Okay. I didn't include that.
Because they are just not dividing, or?
Well, the exhausted ones aren't dividing, really. But the inexhausted ones are.
And so the exhausted ones are not killing anyone.
The exhausted ones are killing just as
They're killing.
Yeah. Well, so in the killing assays, they're doing just as well. But
they don't secrete interferon gamma.
They're not secreting it as much. So
as
they
much.
Do in, I think these are, I should have to tell them. But I, you were on the paper that looked at this, I thought. But when they looked at the killing rate of these cells, so they take and they pulse cells with peptide and then look at the rate at which they're cleared from the spleen. But there's a big effect of how much peptide is on the cells, I guess, when you look at clearance. So anyway, what they found was that the killing rate was maybe reduced by a factor of 2, which is not very significant. So it is lower. The reduction in interferon gamma expression reduces the killing rate, but not significantly. And so I'll put up some plots of data, and we can kind of look at and eyeball what the effect is of changing the killing rate by a factor of 2, but it doesn't end up being that much. So there is this dependence on how much peptide is being expressed that nobody's really exploring.
I'm sorry, probably I missed that. What is exhaustion now?
Exhaustion, that's a good question. People are working on explaining it. Some people would say that it's a deficiency in killing. But it also seems to affect the proliferation rate of the cells. Because as I showed in that initial plot, the T cells go up and then they come back down. There's still plenty of pathogen there, so why isn't the population isn't persisting at the high levels? It's not continuing to grow indefinitely. It goes up and comes back down. So it seems that that exhaustion limits proliferation. It does a number of things, but that's
only in CD4 depleted animals.
What's that?
Well, it's only in CD4 depleted animals the virus persists when you.
Yeah. But you see, it's exhaustion, even when you have CD4.
You see exhaustion, but the virus is mainly. I mean, it's controlled pretty well actually in most organs. I mean, it's not controlled in a couple of places, but in the spleen it's clear.
Okay.
Blood is clear. Under normal circumstances, and then, you know, when you don't have CD4, that's true.
Yeah, so I think it's cleared by the antibodies, and that's what you see when you clear it. Remove the CD4. Is that, maybe that's just a hypothesis.
Well, I mean, CD4's help for CD8 seems to be important as well.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's...
And the CD4 helps, seems like it rescues T cells from exhaustion.
Yeah, zinc and aggregate would argue that that's all B cells.
Okay, that's what I'm...
So if I understand Anton's question, he was wondering how you're identifying an exhausted cell. Is it simply on the lower expression of interferon gamma?
No, it's on the PD-1 expression.
On the PD-1 expression.
Yeah.
You're not tracking cell numbers here, are you?
No, I am.
The rho, I thought, was a density.
It is. But if you integrate rho over the entire space from 0 to 1 on PD-1. Yeah, it'll be a number that changes with time.
So it's not normalized.
It's not. It reflects the total of the same index. Oh, and actually I have it.
And then S is the proliferation rate, is that what it is?
S is the division rate, the maximal division rate.
So high PD-1 is the exhausted or non-exhausted?
The what?
High PD-1 expression, is it exhausted?
High PD-1 is exhausted.
So then wouldn't you have to include the division terms for the cells which have high PD-1? The one which are not.
Yeah. So are you worried about the dilution?
Yeah.
I didn't. And I think I'm not sure how important that would be. It's worth looking at. So the last bit here is that I may not get to is on epigenetic data where they looked at demethylation of the PD-1 regulatory region. So if that is actually regulating PD-1 expression, then I think I'm safe. So the order of these projects is opposite to the way they're being presented. I did this first and then thought about things more generally. And so it might be that I have to revisit that, because that's a really good question. And I guess the other bit there is that if division is slow in comparison to PD-1 upregulation time, characteristic time, then it's okay. But it seems like both are slow, so I'm not sure. But thank you. Does anybody else have them? Yes.
So you were saying that the thymic output decreases with infection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing is during the infection, I think during any infection, you have this nonspecific reduction in thymic output, that you have like a thymic involution, and it doesn't work as efficiently. But the other thing is you might expect that some of the virus might be getting into the thymus, being presented during the selection process for T cells. So I don't know if that happens or not. The LCMV virus seems like it infects some dendritic cells. Seems like it infects a lot of cells. But anyway, the dendritic cells might be trafficking through the thymus. We're going to explore that a little bit more. Are you concerned with that, or just curious? Yeah, I don't know. I thought that's sort of the question that we want to get at. Is that important to consider thymic influx? Is it important to consider a reduction in thymic influx? So here's just the simulation of the model. The black line gives the total T cell number. It goes up and it comes back down over time, and then it's persistent. Initially, I have a real homogeneous distribution of PD-1 expression that's low, and the cells become exhausted. They go to red here, and then the yellow at the bottom here is really the effect of new inexhausted T cells that are entering the population, and that gives rise to the heterogeneity that you see here at the end in the persistent state. Anybody got any questions on that?
What does the data look like of the PD-1 expression as a function of time infection?
It's this one here. Too bad I didn't zoom in on that.
So you haven't plotted it? Is it very
I should have done that. I don't have a plot of that. Do I? No, I don't. I'm sorry. The paper has a plot of what you expect from the model at this state here. but I don't have that in the slide. It depends on it's somewhat sensitive to the parameters in the model. But the general features is on a log scale, it sort of looks like this. So log of number, and then this is linear here. I guess that's the opposite of what people usually want. In which case, I think it would be pretty.
Might want to turn the lights on.
Thank you. Yeah. So one thing that can happen when you have a model like this is that we can actually have this. Go off to infinity, and it remains integrable and finite in this region, the number of cells that are there, even though this stretches to infinity. It's still biologically meaningful, but that's one of the key bits about the sensitivity to the parameters. What we ended up using had this nice turn over here.
That's the x-axis?
The x-axis was normalized PD-1 expression. and it's a linear axis. So I think if I, normally you would have the log of expression on the horizontal axis and then linear on that, so it'd be very sharply peaked over there, just like we expected to see. Is that a...
How much would you need to increase K in order to eliminate the pathogen?
Yeah, that's a really good... Oh, the killing rate?
Yeah. Oh. Or whatever you can change in order to make it non-persistent.
That's a good question. Let's see if maybe we can answer that in the next slide. Oh, sorry. Did anybody else have that?
So this infection is systemic?
Oh, well, yeah, LCMDs, yeah. Yeah, actually, this model is for systemic infections. We're not really considering like sequestered pathogens, mycobacteria, or these things that can sort of hide from the immune system. So in the chronic state, you can just look at the steady states of the model. And so you can get an answer to this of what the total number of T cells are at equilibrium, and you find that either you have to have too low pathogen so that the death rate is still higher than the division rate of the T cells, or you have to have high enough level of pathogen that you're driving the T cells to exhaustion. And if you're in the intermediate region, the number of T cells is unbounded. Then factoring in the pathogen equation at equilibrium, you find that you get two possible stationary states. The trajectory of most acute infections is that I start off with a low number of T cells and a little bit of pathogen, and then the pathogen comes out pretty quickly, and then the immune system kicks in and clears it, and it sort of orbits around this point into clearance over here. And then the T cell declines to some memory state. It looks like HIV actually converges to this point. But for the most part, persistent infections come out and then converge over to this one. So this state here is characterized by high T cell number, low pathogen density, and low exhaustion in the T cell population. And this point here is lower T cell number, high pathogen density, and high exhaustion. So let's see, you wanted to know about killing rate and how it changed. So killing rate here, really that's shifting this bit here. So it changes that point, which might not be very relevant for the chronic states that we're interested in. Here, if I shift this up and down, it doesn't do anything. So that's sort of getting...
Oh, but you can lose the intersection with the T-cell curve. You can lose that steady state if the pathogen curve goes too low.
Right. If this comes out, yeah. And that also has to do with the reduction in T-cells, the blocking of thymic output.
There's no clearance of the pathogen, right?
No, you could have. I mean, what we're studying, there's not. But the model does have trajectories that clear the pathogen depending on what the parameters are of the pathogen.
Well, if you define clearance, well, less
right.
Pathogen.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, because retreating pathogen density is a continuum. Then I could have 10 to the minus 5 pathogen. Yeah. At some point, right?
But I mean,
a couple precision numbers.
Better than some general concentrations for the number of particles per total body.
Yeah. So anyway, they have things that I think correspond biologically to clearance. Okay, so talked about those two states. Okay. So if you take exhaustion out of the model, then you only have this state, which normally corresponds to clearance, because these cells aren't limited in their proliferative capacity anymore. If you don't have thymic influx, this is the only state that you get, because the cells that you had initially all get driven to exhaustion, and then they all decay away.
If there's a division and dilution, then maybe...
Yeah, or asymmetric cell. I haven't looked at that yet, and so I think that that's something that I want to go back and look at.
As a population, the cells do divide kind of slowly, but there might be huge heterogeneity, and I'm thinking, look at that very carefully.
Yeah, I mean, you do see that initial decline in number.
I'm talking about the chronic more stage.
Yeah.
Is the proliferation or not? Well, there is proliferation, we know that.
Right.
But it's not very dramatically big if you just do the RDU labeling.
Okay.
But it's still possible, and nobody has done careful, CFC dilution type of things.
Okay.
That there might be cells that divide a lot, and the majority of cells don't divide at all, or very little, and those that divide a lot, maybe they are diluting their PE1 all the time.
Yeah.
So you don't need influx of new cells, essentially, to maintain.
That's a clear prediction you have here for thymectomy. Have they actually looked at thymectomized mice?
I have to check my paper. I thought that they had. Is that?
Yeah, I don't remember the answer.
So the other thing is that they do a congenital infection of LCMV, and they get no T cell response, and the viral load is.
Yeah, but that's slightly different because you're inducing tolerance there, aren't they?
Right.
But, there's a very clear prediction about the role of the thymus here, so it seems to be a very obvious experiment to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've done it. I just don't remember the answer.
Well, it's...
That's the worst possible answer.
It's the worst possible answer.
So I didn't know if they had done the experiment or not.
Well, I know for polyomal virus, they've done it for several infections. I just wrote a little number. I think for all CME, it was always required, but...
Okay. I'm sorry. This is the paper that I think that you're an author on.
How would
you
know?
What's his name at Emory?
Lukacher?
Yeah.
Hello.
So I thought that they did that experiment with a thymectomized mouse.
So for poliomyelitis, I think thymus is required. They showed it.
So they did LCMV in that paper also.
LCMV was different.
Okay.
I think.
But the answer is you don't know, so.
Okay.
Yes, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. So that means we should do the experiment.
No. It has been done. Just go.
But if we don't know the answer. Okay. Sorry.
I mean, with thymectomy, it's careful. You are predicting kind of maybe when you remove the thymus, prior to infection or during the infection. Sometimes that may be important. And I think they did it before the infection.
Okay. Here's one of the points here that whether I had thymic influx or not, or whether I have T cells or not, is really not doing anything to change the quantity of pathogen that's in the system, and that corresponds with what we see in at least congenital infections and possibly with thymectomized mice. Okay, so the pathogen load is not controlled by T cells. Okay, so what if pathogen didn't inhibit T cell development? So here I looked at, this is a curve, this is the standard curve using that Hill function for reducing thymic output. This is if we didn't reduce thymic output. This thymic output corresponds to having 200 precursor cells. And you can see in this case there is no chronic state because there's no intersection of that curve in that. And that means that there's only clearance in that case. So somehow you have to reduce the thymic output. And the other bit here, this is an immunosenescent model where, as you age, your thymus really reduces the output. This is reducing by a couple orders of magnitude. And in that way, you have the chronic state arise again. So I don't know, that might be, I mean, it sort of corresponds with intuition that we have. Yeah, Vitaly.
Yeah, but given that idea that it means, so moving up means that you have less and less influence on the virus on the immune, on the thymus. So if you look at that model, then it means that in people that there's no thymic production at all, they should always clear an infection or control it well. Like aged individuals should control infection very well.
Wait, what? No, I think it's the opposite. Let's go over this. This is a full thymic output.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry.
That's okay. It'd be really interesting if what you said was true. Okay, so I think that's the conclusion there. Persistence probably requires both exhaustion and reduced thymic output. Okay, so I don't know. It's I think maybe getting late. No, so nobody's really talked about. So I have to correct that paper because somebody went and looked at demethylation of the PD-1 locus, the regulatory region, and this is the data. And so each of these little circles represents a CpG dyad on the DNA in this little region before the PD-1 gene. And in high PD-1 expression, these are all demethylated. In low PD-1 expression cells, they still remain methylated. And so the model that we made was based on thinking about changes in production level. And that you'd have production and decay over time, and this, so there's no real model when we set out for analyzing what should be happening with DNA methylation. Unfortunately, we don't get to the answer yet. We sort of got into it and found some other interesting things, and now that I have those, I'd like to go back and revisit the exhaustion bit. But so let's see. Anyway, I guess I'll jump into it. Maybe we could talk about this another time if people are interested.
Yeah, it's in private groups, yeah.
Yeah, I'm getting a little hoarse and I'm still recovering from this flu. Well, thank you guys very much.